So as Bruce said, my background is in biogeochemistry, forest soils. I've worked in a lot of wetlands, primarily on some disturbance ecology there, the impacts of forest harvesting, hurricanes, thermal pollution even near the Aiken nuclear facility and wetlands, effects on wetlands. And so a lot of that work dealt with decomposition, below ground productivity, things like this, and I also worked a bit in water quality. And so as we progress through our career, different disturbances come into vogue. So the importance of some disturbances change. One of the big ones, as you're all aware right now, is landscape evolution and the loss of natural systems to urbanization. So we began to look into this large landscape scale study, and I have to admit I was not prepared for what we found. The degree of contamination of water in an urban area was horrific. I'd never seen anything like it in terms of even a disturbed forest stream or an agricultural stream. And so as we worked in those systems, we found streams that were, after a rain, would have higher E. coli counts than were observed in the streets of New Orleans after Katrina. No big disturbance, it just rained. And so the streams, many of those streams, riparian areas, went right through residential areas. And so we began to think about the implication for children's health, for human health, and approached the CDC and asked them about this. They said, absolutely, that's a big health risk. We don't know quite how to get our hands around that because the epidemiological side of that is very complicated. For example, if you have a highly contaminated stream, you have to be able to tie, let's say, looking at children's health, a child's presence in that water to whatever disease or illness they come down with. That was a trick. And so they suggested if you're interested in this topic, you might look into West Nile virus a little bit more. That's more either you have it or you don't. And so it's also tied in very closely to polluted water and riparian zones. And so that's where we went with this. This is how we got into this. And so my goal this morning, you all seen this classic list of traditional societal values and functions of wetlands many times. And so there are different forms of it. Some things are in it, one list and not in another. But I think it would be time to think about whether it's possible to add to that list the protection of human health. Now, this flies in the face of wetland reputation. So this is a tall order. But two reasons that I suggest this. I think there's great value in this. One, you're really helping people. But I would like to emphasize, I'm only talking about mosquitoes. There are other factors associated with wetlands like hurricane abatement, which are extremely important and will become more so as we have the higher frequency of aberrant events due to climate change. So there are other factors here too. I'm just talking about mosquitoes. So it's very relevant. If you talk to prospective grad students these days, I'm also a graduate program officer. The potential grad students are more astute than we were back in the olden days, and they're very interested in doing something that means something. And so potentially if you get into some of the stuff I'm talking about, it's possible that you might contribute in some way to someone not getting sick or maybe not dying, and that's no kidding really. And so that's a highly relevant topic. Also, as we continue to intensify the onslaught against natural resources and globally, I've had quite a bit of experience, I know you have too, in talking to non-scientific groups, city councils and whoever, groups of citizens, about conservation of natural resources. And so that can be very difficult. You have to think about it from their perspective. So when I talk about, you know, trees are good, deer are good, they glaze over, probably get up and leave the room. Biodiversity, you don't have a prayer with that one with a non-scientific group. But if I tell them that if we maintain biodiversity, I don't say they use that word because they may not understand it, more species of fish or more species of birds in association with some of our wetland areas, that may lower the risk of West Nile virus. And they sit back and listen. That lights up the night. Whereas they're getting ready to leave the room, you know, all of a sudden you said something that might keep their child from getting sick. And so it's a very powerful argument for conservation of some of these areas that are continuously eroding. So back to what we have to push against. I know we've all seen quotes like this. Some of them are so classic that I couldn't stay away from them. This I lifted from Mitch and Gosling. Horrible desert about wetlands. Foul damps ascend without ceasing, corrupt the air, and render it unfit for respiration. Never was rum, that cordial of life, whatever a cordial is, found more necessary. So now I discover why, when I've been in a swamp in August in some southern state, that I really start thinking about a cold beer. So that cordial of a life is a cold beer to me. So I can understand that linkage now. And then over a century later, this quotation is from Goss. Goss was an English tutor that came to work with a family in western Alabama prior to the Civil War. And here's what he had to say about a cypress swamp there. Gloom, savage, somber, half-tepid, stagnant, shutting out the light, gaunt, ragged, dreariness, and desolation. About a system now that's taken for granted, I think, is being very beautiful. So my point is, these are historical descriptions of these areas. Still, with a lot of people, if you have a swamp nearby, if you have some kind of a wetland nearby, the people are afraid of snakes. They don't like the mosquitoes. We can differentiate here between types of mosquitoes. A nuisance mosquito and something that's a health risk. So there's all of this background to push against as we do this. So that's a very, very urgent topic. As strong reasons for links with health threats. This is the World Health Organization malaria data for 2015. 212 million new cases, 90% of those in Africa. 429,000 deaths that year. That's a low estimate. Usually the estimates you see are higher than that, maybe 500,000-600,000 per year. And so this is a very critical topic for a number of reasons. This is an Anopheles mosquito that you see here on the left. And this is a degraded human red blood cell after being exposed to the malaria pathogen. So I'm also going to talk about West Nile virus, which there was an outbreak of that in the U.S. in 2012 that killed, I think, 250 or so people, most of those in near Houston, Texas. We're not sure why. there's been about 1,600 people in the U.S. that have died from West Nile. There's actually a mild outbreak right now. And so in many states across the country, there's a higher incidence of West Nile. In Georgia, for example, there's been about 45 cases and 5 deaths in, I think, the last 4 or 5 months. So in malaria, in terms of the United States, we really don't have much of a problem with that. According to CDC, there's about 1,000 cases a year. Most of those are from people who traveled to other areas and were infected there. But obviously, from a global perspective, Anopheles mosquito is a very deadly thing. Malaria was not always, if we look back at the past, we can kind of see where we've come from and where we may head. Malaria was not always rare in the United States. And so back in the late 19th century, it was very prominent in most of the eastern two-thirds of the United States. In 1912, it began to get restricted to the southern United States. 32, it was very restricted, and then rebounded a little bit in 34, 35. One reason that it became restricted during these years is the Rockefeller Foundation came into the South and worked a lot with the poor people. And by the way, that's a recurring theme that's very definitely true. When you get into environmental health, if some of you have ever heard the story of the Broad Street pump during the London cholera epidemic, that's a good story if you ever want to read something, there's a book about it. That was what was primarily dealing with poor people. The malaria in the South was as well. People who were too poor to have screens on their houses did not know much about sanitation. They were uneducated. And so some of the work that I'm going to talk about in a moment is also linked to the poor people. This is, again, back to the past. This is 1930. This is 1940. And so the blue line are the actual data points. And so you see that about 6 people per year died in about, I'm guessing, 17 counties. That's a lot. This is one state. This is just Alabama. And so this was probably pretty common throughout the southern coastal plain. So if we had that number of people dying now, you can imagine our horrific reaction to that. That's a lot. And so in 1940, maybe a little bit better, although in about 19 counties we had one die. And so still very, very common. It's interesting, during a significant drought, the Palmer Drought Index here, there was a dip in the number of malaria deaths. Interestingly enough, if you'd seen a drought like that, in the case of West Nile virus, the cases probably would have gone up. So all of these transmission cycles are a little bit different. This is an old photograph of somebody spraying Paris Green into a southern swamp. I think the primary ingredient of that material was arsenic. This is what the can looked like, and this was a public relations photo showing pupae that apparently don't feel very well. And so this is kind of a terrible thing to see, that you would actually spray arsenic into a wetland anywhere. But we got to look at this through the perspective of those people who were dying. This was a very serious issue. And so we have to weigh the choice of using that insecticide against human deaths. So the Rockefeller Foundation encouraged a lot of the pesticide use. They did draining a lot of wetlands, which we always talk about how wetland loss has been associated with draining. Some of that was for agriculture. Some of it was to reduce disease. So mosquitoes are the best known as the most dangerous animal in the world. Probably the Anopheles here, the mosquito that carries malaria, is probably the most dangerous. Probably the only thing that would come close to it would be human males. The West Nile virus is carried by Culex species, also some other species as well. With my Appalachian accent, I'm not going to try to pronounce that, but the medical people call them quince. And so there are other species besides the quince that carry West Nile. And then over here with Zika, I'm not going to go without mentioning it, the Aedes aegypti mosquito, which carries that. Malaria and West Nile are heavily associated with wetlands, not so with Zika. Zika is more associated with containers around homes, tree cavities that are full of water, things like that. So again, the nuances of the mosquito habitat, the transmission cycles, are very, very critical to know. So there is another obstacle that we need to get past that, according to a very interesting book called Wetlands and Human Health, not surprisingly, that the benefits for human health may be inversely related to loss of ecosystem services. But this is in reference to going in and doing major manipulations that we'll talk about in a moment. And so one recurring theme that I hope to stay with is that if we have healthy wetlands, those are good for human health for the most part. But I'm not going to try to tell you, convince you, that if you have a healthy, well-functioning wetland, you're not going to be bitten by a Culex mosquito. That's certainly possible. But in general, healthy, well-functioning wetlands are safer for people. So when we get into serious health threats, or when hydrology and biogeochemistry are altered in wetlands, this is an urban stream. That type of stream is extremely common in urban areas. And then agriculture as well. Sometimes you can get very high levels of E. coli, a lot of organic matter in there. Same thing with the urban stream. Again, the pollution, the E. coli counts, fecal coliform are so high in these things. Again, I have no medical training. I should have mentioned that up front, so some of you might want to leave. But when I talk and I give some presentations in an outreach manner, I talk about how if you live in any size city, even a small city, you probably don't want to let your child or even your pet get into what's an urban stream. They are not clean. Now, cities and municipalities clean up that water before it goes back into, say, for like Columbus, Georgia, the Chattahoochee River. But the problem is this kind of stuff flows through residential areas. And so that's kind of a sleeper issue. But I think it's, according to CDC, it's a very serious one. So what happens with hydrology? And so if you have natural ground cover, you may have in this generalized diagram about 10% runoff. This is the box to watch, 40% evapotranspiration. If you go to 10 to 20% impervious, which is not much, that's like a suburb where the houses are fairly widely dispersed. The runoff doubles, evapotranspiration drops. You get up to 35-50%, that might be the level that you would see, say, in the middle of a college campus, for example. Still a good bit of green space, but this is getting pretty serious. You're up to 30%, and if you go to downtown Atlanta, it's 55%. So two things are associated with that runoff. One, the velocity is very high, which causes problems, and it is absolutely filthy. Because when you get these storm surges, there's a lot of effort on stormwater management. You're probably aware of that in urban areas. It picks up everything but the kitchen sink. Hormones, all sorts of stuff are in urban waters, and none of it good. The stability of the hydro period is also significantly affected. This is a hydrograph of a watershed that's primarily forested, I think a reference watershed. The dark jagged line here is precipitation. You barely see any reaction from the discharge line. You come down into an urban watershed. I think this one had about 35% impervious. There's your rain, same rainfall, and look at the hydrograph. It's all over the place, very spiky, very unstable. And so, coupling the velocity and the amount of runoff with what, are there any, I don't know if there are any engineers present, I don't mean to step on your toes, but what appears to many people to be a really bad engineering idea, a combined stormwater sewer overflow, which if you live in the eastern United States, you probably, these are around a lot in cities. The idea was that you'd link the stormwater and sewers, stormwater drains and the sewers. So when it rained a lot, the stormwater drains would overflow into the sewers. And what happens is it blasts off the manhole cover. This is dilute sewage. And so having worked in some streams near these things, I'm telling you, it's not very dilute. And so with this engineering solution, and it, again, it doesn't take, you know, a heavy thunderstorm will do this. We can revert back to the sanitation of the streets of London in 1840. So this is a common incident in a lot of cities. And so what happens is it flows downhill, goes into our riparian zone, into a stream, and away it goes. Now, this is some data, for CSO data, combined stormwater sewer overflow. Water and West Nile virus incidence in Quince and QX mosquitoes. This is some data out of Emory University. And so the dark clouds here, the kind of reddish dark clouds, are incidence of QX mosquitoes. If you can make out these triangles over here in this expanded view, are the locations of the CSOs. So some of these type of data out of Emory University resulted in a $3 billion, with a B, retrofitting of the stormwater sewer system in Atlanta, because obviously these things are health threats. It seems to me, and based on what I've read and what I've observed, that oftentimes the CSOs are located in poor socioeconomic areas that don't have a lot of political influence. Also, I can attest to the fact that in those areas, you're more likely to see a cracked sewer pipe, things like this. The infrastructure need in the U.S. that everybody talks about is very acute in areas like that. They don't have the political influence to get people in there to fix that. So data like this from Emory was a huge benefit. So in terms of wetlands and different types of mosquitoes, we won't spend a lot of time on this, but a lot of 80 species associated bottomland swamps, a lot of them associated with Atlantic white cedar forest. Don't know why. Bottomland swamp, Mississippi, the triple E is eastern encephalitis, WN is West Nile. Some of these are just nuisance mosquitoes. Some more 80s here, and some anopheles, which potentially could carry malaria. I mean, the mosquitoes that carry this are still here. Bottom and swamps, Mississippi Delta, riverine systems, again, Atlantic white cedar locations, eastern encephalitis, West Nile, down here in the freshwater systems, cattails, bottom and swamps. And one final view. This is Culex. All these carrying West Nile. The SLE is St. Louis encephalitis. Again, bottom and swamps, Atlantic white cedar, playas, and so on and so forth. So the great variety of mosquitoes associated with our wetland systems. All of them not health risks, but some of them, I mean, none of them pleasant. So one of the points I made earlier about maintaining aquatic biodiversity and healthy system is if you have a good bit of aquatic biodiversity, you have a lot of predators that may eat the mosquitoes. Unfortunately, or I would say unfortunately, a lot of wetlands have been seeded with mosquito fish, which are apparently not much better at eating mosquitoes than some of the native species over here, but they also can be very destructive to the ecological system. If they're, because they're non-native and can cause unintended consequences. So it's better to maintain the health of a wetland and the promote the native aquatic species. So if we're looking at a place a mosquito might like to live, we're looking at systems with high nutrients, ample supplies of high quality carbon. They have to have that. Both of those are in plentiful supply in water related to a CSO. Low aquatic vertebrate abundance means low numbers of predators. Low flow, moderately dense vegetation. They like vegetated areas apparently because it's a good carbon source associated with that and also provides resting places. So we kept hearing when we got into this that the Culex mosquitoes would only breed near CSOs. And so we wondered about that with our background with pollution associated with urban streams. And so we came in after the retrofitting. This is related to our study in Atlanta. And so we looked at some of the containers, the forest streams, urban streams, and containers, and assessed the levels of nutrients in those just to see if Culex could breed in these things. So these are some of the levels we saw. In a lot of the urban streams, they're kind of hot for nitrate, even at 0.74 milligrams per liter, a little hot for a forested stream. Obviously, there's probably some development in that catchment. And so not much forest, not much phosphate down here. And so Matt Ricker, when he was at Auburn, did some very interesting studies based around those levels of nutrients that we saw. And so earlier, some of the earlier work with this, and I'm not taking anything away from the medical people because I listen to them very closely on all this work, but they're very good at doing many things I can't do. But when you get into like nutrition studies, people like us, biochemistry specialists, are perhaps a little better trained. They would spike, have two treatments, one with dog food, one without. And they get a proliferation of mosquitoes in the dog food treatment. And so that's interesting, but a little hard to interpret. So Matt went at this like we would for, say, a fertilization study, an aquatic fertilization study. And he set this up with 1 gram leaf litter, a mixture of native species, I think 200 larvae per liter. And then he began to spike some inorganic nitrogen and phosphorus. And so the mosquitoes didn't do very well. And so this is the total adults per mesocosm, very, very low across all three types of systems. So he redid the study, I say with higher C. He got the higher C by cutting in half the larval density. He went with 100 per liter in this experiment. And again, spiking with elevated ammonium, nitrate, and phosphate. And so this is very interesting. He got a strong response to phosphorus. Very little, actually a suppressing response compared to the reference to all the nitrogen, ammonium or nitrate that came in there. And so that was very interesting to see. And so again, this is some of Matt's work, showing the predicted relationship between number of adults and phosphate up to about 6 milligrams per liter, which is very high, but not as high as you would find in a CSO or something like that. Nitrate up to about 14, an inverse relation, and same thing with ammonium. And so at this point, I think a critical question, an appropriate question might be, well, you know, what does it matter? I mean, you've already told us, we already know that clean, perhaps oligotrophic systems are better at reducing mosquito numbers. Do we really need to know the difference between 4 and 6 milligrams per liter and what that has an effect on mosquitoes? Well, probably not. It's probably not practical from a management standpoint, but where it is important, if you work with epidemiologists, and with my background in wetland biogeochemistry, no pun intended, wade out into the water of this type of work without staying very close to the epidemiologist, which was interesting. When I first approached some of those people at some of the medical schools, I thought that they would, you know, shoo me away because I was not of their ilk, but they were actually pretty enthused. And so that was we got a very good reception. So, you know, if any other biogeochemists come along or ecologists, now, we're better at the dosing type of study. We're better at analyzing remotely sensed information. But in couple with them, we can do a lot. So influence of litter quality is also a big deal. This is from Hamid Majidzadeh's work, also at Auburn, when he did mesocosms with different types of vegetation. And so, again, 3 native species and then turf grass, which occurs around a lot of wetlands, particularly in urban environments. And you see something that's a little ominous here. The turf grass spiked mesocosms have a much higher number of species, or percent of species that achieve the pupae status, much higher percent of adult females and adult males. And so that is linked to litter quality. Because if we look at some litter quality metrics associated with those 4 species, we can see that the CN ratio is pretty narrow, or narrower than for the 3 tree species, and the lignin concentration is quite low. So that has big management implications in terms of if there's some way to keep grass out of some of the wetlands and constructed wetlands or whatnot related to residential areas or any urban area. So this is, I'm going to show you a number of sets of data like this. This is a study that these folks, Kaufman et al., did with water from tree holes, which, you know, many mosquitoes breed in that as well. And so based on back in the day when I measured a lot of stem flow through fall, that water is very enriched. There's a lot of nutrients in it. And so also, again, the spiking of nitrate, phosphate, the glucose, a readily available carbon source, caused the biggest increase. This is bacterial production. The combination of glucose with the nitrate and phosphate was not different from the glucose alone. This is from the same publication. And so this was high and low nutrients. I think in the low nutrients here, or the no nutrients, there's none. This had about, I think, 0.5 milligrams per liter and 5 milligrams per liter. The 0.5 is phosphate. The others nitrate. And so no separation there between none and some added. They cut the low down in half of that to 0.25 and 2.5, and then doubled the high rate to 1 and 10. And so they did get some separation of that. And apparently it makes a difference during the stages there when the nutrients are added. So in the first week was less than the middle week, which was also much greater than the final week. These are some data for Culex mosquitoes associated with mesocosms established in a constructed wetland in California that was filled with a bulrush. And so in the autumn, if we look at the 3 levels of high ammonium, Those range from 15 to 50 milligrams per liter, which were about the loading levels for this constructed wetland. And so we see a separation between those three levels in the control, no separation among the three levels. We come down here to summer. This kind of petered out, they thought, because of cooler temperatures in the autumn. We come down here in the summer, and there is more separation among the higher levels because of the warmer temperatures. And then the same study is showing anopheles responses. And so in the summer, again, there was more separation. Same thing down here between the high and the control, low versus medium. So this is interesting. So they did get quite a response to ammonium. Matt's work showed very little response, or a negative response to ammonium. Why that is, no clear idea. Another example, people would tell you that mosquitoes don't breed in moving water. They do breed in slowly moving water. These are from some urban streams in China, looking at three species of mosquitoes that occur here. Aedes albopictus, by the way, is one of the reasons that we probably don't get hit too hard with Zika. Albopictus has largely replaced Aedes aegypti in many areas of the south, and so this does not carry Zika to the point that aegypti does. Also, we don't have the active reservoir associated with primates that is influential in Zika outbreaks. But nonetheless, back to this, stagnant or slow water preferred. Most near aquatic vegetation don't like open water. Presence of fish reduce the larvae. And they're positively correlated with ammonium, total N, total P, dissolved phosphorus and biological oxygen demand, negatively with pH, dissolved oxygen, and nitrate. So if you get back to the conflict, conundrum about increasing mosquito control in wetlands by manipulation, this is harder than meets the eye. It can increase the flow rate, but sometimes the rate of flow necessary to move mosquitoes out or hurt mosquitoes is high enough to do some damage to some of the other wetland functions. Reduce the amount of vegetation, create open water. Again, that might not coincide with good wetlands functions. And also reduce nutrient organic matter influx. So again, this depends on if we know anything about the loading capacity of wetlands, how much can be tolerated there before you reach saturation. That would play into an epidemiological model as well. So other considerations, one point I need to make that I have not so far is that the transmission cycles for these things are extremely complicated. I've been talking about wetlands, there are many other facets. And so for West Nile, that would include socioeconomic conditions. Again, the same factor as with the malaria in the south. People in the summer who are poor and can't afford air conditioning, rather than close their house up in stifling heat, they might keep the windows of the doors open. Okay, they're more susceptible. Also, the degraded infrastructure associated sometimes with sewer lines, CSOs, if it's more proximity of that to the poor neighborhoods, they're at greater risk. Outreach public education is very important. People pick up on this very quickly. I don't think anybody, I don't recall, in fact I know, when I was doing picking up litter bags and putting them in a wetland, not to say that that type of work is unimportant at all. I mean, that's my first love. That's what I love to do. And carbon cycling, things like that are very critical. But nobody in the public ever took notice of that. It was too far removed. We have people come out from their houses and thank us for working on trying to find out more about West Nile virus. They'll come out and say, you know, my wife died from it in 2012. Thank you for doing this. And so that's a measure that gives you an indication of the relevance, how quickly you can touch people who control what we do in urban centers, the voters. And most of that power is in the urban centers, and so a place we don't normally like to go. But it's worthwhile to work there because, again, those are the people who are in need of help for the most part. Repair of degraded infrastructure, that's a very complicated one, an acute need, easy to see. It involves policy, you know, city councils, unfortunately very complicated. Improve risk prediction. And so what our goal is, and many people's goal, is to develop risk maps for West Nile virus, for Zika, whatever. And so you show areas across a landscape where the perfect storm of risk factors coincides. And so in that location, yeah, people need to be aware you have greater risk than 10 miles over here where you don't have that same assemblage. And we recommend, I mean, a lot of people are following the One Health concept, which is something that we might tie wetlands in more closely. That concept is basically the nexus between people, animals, and the environment in terms of health. And so it's a concept that's catching on more and more broadly, and it's a concept in which people in wetlands like us, ecologists, biogeochemists, can play a big role. And again, if there's interest in that, the medical people, for the most part, will welcome you. So again, just to indicate the complexity of West Nile, and again, because I'm focusing on one factor, with West Nile, forest characteristics are important. Some of that we found that, us and others, have found that larger forest patches exhibit or are associated with lower vector indices for West Nile. That's the dilution effect. And I'll speculate because, you know, as you get older, you get old, you can speculate a lot. And then if you say something ridiculous, you can claim you don't remember you said it. But I would not be surprised at all if large wetlands carried the same potential to reduce mosquito risk because of the potential for greater biodiversity. That's the thing about the bigger forest patches with West Nile, also Lyme disease in the Northwest. Urban hydrology, also one thing about forest characteristics, just as an aside, as the percent pine composition goes up in a forest, West Nile incidence goes down. We have no idea why. The urban hydrology, which is incredibly problematic. Corvid habitat, just like the Zika has an active reservoir in primates, a group of birds called corvids, which is crows, blue jays, a robin is not a corvid, but are an active reservoir. So this offers a potential angle on disrupting a transmission cycle. Corvids like scattered small fragments of forest. And so if you have larger forests, back to that dilution effect, you don't see, maybe they don't have as much of an active reservoir to replenish their West Nile virus pathogens from. By the way, a robin apparently is very active in that too. Worked with a disease ecologist who referred to these as flying bags of virus, which just completely, you know, marred my view of robins from now. I kind of run from one if I see it. And big socioeconomic influence. And so that's the same with malaria, Zika. And so to approach all of this, it depends on what you want to do. If you want to clarify the biogeochemistry and the urban hydrology, that's a worthwhile endeavor. If you want to get into the whole big picture, you really, this is what I would call hardcore interdisciplinary. And so you've got to have a team that works together well. If the University of Florida has an excellent program in this type of thing, If you work with people called medical entomologists, disease ecologists, they'll talk to you. They kind of bridge the gap. But even those people are very glad to see people like us show up because we have great depth of knowledge in some of these ecological factors. And then the Culex mosquito here, the mosquito habitat, nutrients in the water, we've already talked about. So what effect would climate change have on all this? It's a very complicated question. You know, I would be tempted to say, okay, it's going to rain more and get hotter. This is what's going to happen to the pools of water. But, you know, what's climate change going to do to socioeconomics and so on and so forth? That's a very complicated question. So I'll leave you with one thought. I always close my mosquito presentations with this painting by Monet, chrysanthemums, because it's from those flowers permethrin is made. And so I ask you, you know, how to make a mosquito laugh. You know, try to drive her away with a citronelle candle or something like that that smells sweet. Or maybe even one of those little gadgets that makes a humming noise. I don't know. I haven't heard anybody say those work well. But the permethrin, if you're serious about something carrying a disease, that'll do the trick. So with that, thank you very much.